This is episode number 800 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to be talking about Jude Law joining Captain Marvel, the Pax of the Lowcountry Kickstarter, Bendis defecting to DC, C.B. Sobolski as Marvel's new EIC, and some farewell thoughts from Matthew and I. Our comics this week will be Spectacular Spider-Man number 6, Doomsday Clock number 1, Venom number 151, and Adam Wreck number 1. And our BoobTube and Big Screen Bonanza goes out with a big screen bang this week as we talk about Thor, Ragnarok, and Justice League.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
God clean the whole for fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here as always with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the early bird, Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I am doing well, except I did not want to get up today, but what a reason to get up.
We are recording this on the day after Thanksgiving.
Yep.
It is the final episode of the Secret Identity podcast, and we are recording at, I believe, about 7:35 in the morning right now.
A crisp, crisp, cold, cold.
It feels almost like Christmas morning.
It does.
We're unwrapping our audio gifts this morning together.
I like that.
It is freezing out. Everything is frozen. We are in the 20s, I believe, now. We're firmly in the... It still feels like fall in late afternoon, but when you get up in the morning, it feels like the dead of winter.
Yeah, I have a couple people that work for me at Amazon that just transferred from California.
Oh.
Much like your opposite,
yes.
The opposite of what you're doing. And the best part was she got all excited. She goes, I had snow today. We saw snow. And I'm like, no, that's frost. That's going to happen every day. And
yeah.
She goes, we didn't even know how to get the stuff off. We brought out water, hot water. And it was really interesting having to explain to somebody from California how to scrape a windshield. Because
yeah.
If you've never done it, it's a completely foreign concept. Plus the fact that we know we need to wake up 5-10 minutes earlier to get the car ready to go. She did not. And that was a whole freaky mess for her.
Yeah. My blood has not gotten used to being back on the East Coast yet because I was – that was, by the way – if you didn't go to the Facebook page, that was the reason that we haven't been able to record for a couple of weeks, neither Secret Identity nor Power Chords podcast, because I have been in California for a couple of weeks. I started a new job and the headquarters of the place that I work for now is in California. And so I've actually been there going through training and that kind of stuff. And so I apologize for the delay, although it seemed like on our Facebook page, Matthew, people were okay with the delay of the final episode of Secret Identity.
Yeah, it just made it go longer.
Yes, people were okay with that. So, and we'll talk a little bit about that before we wrap up the show today. But let's get into our news. And a lot of stuff's been happening.
Yeah, a lot
talk
of changes.
Talk about some big news. This is good. It's almost as if they knew, like, hey, this is the last episode of Secret Identity. Why don't we give them some big news to go out on? We're going to start with something interesting, and we're going to build up to the Megaton. So, first of all, just ahead of Turkey Day, Matthew, this story broke the other day. There's a fun bit of news to chew on. Jude Law is headed to the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Interesting. I like Jude Law.
Per Variety, he'll be joining Brie Larson in Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck's Captain Marvel for the studio. Law is set to play Dr. Walter Lawson, a.k.a. Mar-Vell.
Oh, interesting.
Who becomes a mentor to Larson's Carol Danvers as she begins to navigate her emerging power set. That movie is coming out on March 8th, 2019. But Jude Law.
That's really a good pickup.
Who doesn't like Jude Law?
I loved him in Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow.
Was he at Enemy at the Gates, too?
Enemy at the Gates is one of my favorite war movies. And
Sky Captain was good, too. You're right about that.
Love those movies. And love him. I think he's incredibly versatile because he played some psychopath in a movie I was watching on cable a little while ago. And it took me a little bit to realize it was him.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a guy who – he's like a Cary Elwes to me. Like you say him, I'm like, oh, I like that guy.
Yep.
Sure. I'm sure he'll be fantastic in the Marvel Universe. Let's see what else we got. Oh, as you listen to this, because I am going to put this out, I'm going to endeavor to get this out today on Black Friday while people are standing in line. Hopefully later this afternoon and this evening, they'll be able to listen to this episode. If you are at home and you want nothing to do with the lines for Black Friday, you can go to the PAX of the Lowcountry Kickstarter, which I will put a link to in our show notes. That is the book by our friend Don Cardenas and John Dudley. They are running a special for Kickstarter backers today only. So if you hear this on Friday, you can go to the PAX of the Lowcountry Kickstarter, and they have whole bundles that are dedicated to Black Friday supporters. And so one of the things in one of the bundles is a copy of my book of short stories called Intrusive Thoughts. So that will be included in one of the bundles should you choose to go support that Kickstarter, which has, I believe, 6 days left.
Wow.
And they are around halfway to their funding. So please go and support them. And there are some amazing rewards for backers there, because Don has a lot of friends that we probably have talked about on the show as well in terms of the comic industry people who are contributing to the rewards to that Kickstarter. So go and check that out. What else do we have this week? Oh, this is, I mean, this is just a little tidbit of news, Matthew. I'm going to read this as it was announced. DC Comics announced today that the company has signed comics writer Brian Michael Bendis to an exclusive contract, wooing him away from his longtime home at Marvel Comics. "We are beyond thrilled to welcome Brian Michael Bendis exclusively to the DC family with a multi-year, multifaceted deal," DC wrote in a statement on its official Twitter account. "He's one of the premier writers in the industry, having created so many stories wherever he's been, and we can't wait to see what he has planned for the DC universe. This will be the first time that Bendis has written regularly for DC Comics, following a long and eventful, no pun intended, career." This is from Polygon, by the way. "At Marvel, kicked off by his work on Ultimate Spider-Man, where he eventually co-created and introduced Miles Morales as Spider-Man. He also co-created Jessica Jones and Alias, only one of the many of his projects to find their way to the big screen or be referenced in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. A move to DC Comics, much less a deal for exclusivity with the publisher, marks a big change for the writer and a big change for his fans. Bendis reassured his followers this morning that it was a positive development," and he said this on Twitter. "This is real." That was the first thing he said, because of course people tried to, yes, you know, say it wasn't happening. "I love you all. Change is good. Change is healthy. I am bursting with ideas and inspirations. Details to come. Stay tuned." The article goes on to say, "Certainly there are probably a lot of DC Comics fans out there who are curious to see which characters Bendis will tackle first," and you and I will talk about that in a minute, Matthew. Marvel released an official statement saying, "Brian is a great partner and has contributed incredible stories and characters to the Marvel Universe over the years. We appreciate his creativity and professionalism, and we wish him the best on his future projects." Now, as to why Bendis left and went to DC, there's been a couple of interviews that reference this conversation. And this was, I think he had this conversation initially with a Cleveland newspaper. And he said, "I just had a landmark 50th birthday and I had lost a lot of weight and I was thinking about what else I could do to scare myself," he continued. "What could I do next? DC was coming at me pretty hard with offers that were hard to resist. But it was not until I walked into the library that everything came together. I remembered how much I connected with Superman." This is the Superman Library in Cleveland.
Yes.
"How I was an artist during the 1988 Superman convention in Cleveland. Somehow I did not know about the exhibit. When I walked in and saw it, I felt like the library was my own personal museum that I needed to see and walk through. I then realized I had to take DC up on their offer. It was so head-turning that I really could not refuse." So it was his connection to Superman that kind of pushed that over, because what I think is certainly when I think of DC Comics, no matter who the most popular character of the day is, and I would say right now it's probably Batman in the comics and Wonder Woman in the, you know, cinematic universe. Superman to me is always the character that I will immediately associate with DC Comics, as I associate Spider-Man with Marvel. That is humongous news.
It is.
I mean, that is basically the architect of Marvel's events and some of their major character introductions over the past several years. Someone who, when you thought of Marvel and DC, you thought of Geoff Johns and Brian Michael Bendis, certainly in the time that we've been doing Secret Identity. And so to have him go to DC from Marvel is akin to some of the all-time greats that have worked for both companies, I would say, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the bigger shockers, because I honestly figured he would be – the Karl Yastrzemski, Tom Brady, stayed with the same franchise forever and ever and ever because he is so deep into Marvel's DNA. And the current, over the last 20 years, everything that Marvel is because of Brian Michael Bendis, the way that he has crafted everything. I remember when he first broke with Ultimate Spider-Man number one, and people freaked out about that. They also, I think they gave him X-Men number one because the writer they wanted wasn't able to do it. And you had, so you had all these crazy things where he came in and under nothing but controversial things. Everything that he did was a massive controversy and upset everybody. But all of a sudden, here he is. There's not a Marvel character he hasn't written. The joke has always been, well, gee, he hasn't written Captain America yet. When's he going to be on that one? We would always joke about things like that. But having him over there, to me, it's like having Stan Lee go over. I mean, I know it's maybe with the 1,000 years of his history at DC, at Marvel's a little different. But Stan Lee, if Stan Lee went to DC in the mid-70s, that's what this would have been like. Because he has been Marvel for so long. And it's to have him and Geoff Johns, it's funny when you said that. Having Geoff Johns, you know, and he were always kind of the, you know, the foils for each other. Now they're together. And it's going to be interesting what projects he works on. When you were talking about Superman, I got a little worried because I don't want him on Superman right now because that book is perfect. But it's going to be the sky's the limit for this guy and for DC. And this is the first time DC has really taken somebody away. It's like the small market team has finally made a big trade to get a huge name.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an amazing shift of the landscape and only half of the story that we're sort of talking about now, because I always assumed that at some point he would be offered the EIC job, kind of like a Joe Quesada.
Yep.
You know, that he was going to eventually sort of graduate into that. I don't know how I would have felt about that at the time because I think he's been hit or miss with some of the big events that he's done, but there's no denying his contribution to Marvel Comics, as you just kind of said. So that was a big move. And so, so let's talk about that potential EIC move because this is coming from Newsweek, Matthew. Shortly after we found out that Bendis was leaving, Marvel Entertainment announced that it has a new editor-in-chief.
Yes.
C.B. Cebulski is a comic book editor who has worked in Marvel's global division for more than 15 years. The move comes as Marvel shows greater commitment to diversity in its superheroes and has its eyes as it eyes readership that reaches all over the globe. And this is coming from Newsweek, by the way, not one of the local, you know.
Yeah, not one of our comic book places.
The shakeup comes amid lagging sales for many of Marvel's titles, which outgoing EIC Axel Alonso implied was due to the company's push for ethnically diverse superheroes. Alonso has been Marvel's editor-in-chief since 2011. Let that sink in.
Yeah.
And his tenure was a period of tumultuous sales for the publisher. Marvel Entertainment president Dan Buckley told the New York Times that the company saw, quote, some of our top two or three sales years of all time with Alonso at the helm, but he also oversaw multiple line-wide events that landed with thuds. One of those was the recent Secret Empire, a complex cross-title storyline that positioned Nazi Buster Captain America as an acolyte of the Nazi-like fascist group Hydra. Though the comics were controversial enough to drum up press, sales dropped off after the first two issues, making the event one of the company's worst selling ever.
I did not know that.
Alonso also oversaw the publisher's new Legacy event, which has found some success. Marvel's Legacy number 1 is the best-selling book of the year, and Mighty Thor number 700 was a top-selling issue, according to the publisher. But as The Hollywood Reporter points out, Legacy has overall both underwhelmed fans and underperformed in terms of sales numbers. Let's talk about that in a minute. At a retail summit last year, Marvel's Vice President of Sales, David Gabriel, told attendees that the sales slump was due to updated versions of classic characters, a mixed-race Spider-Man, an Asian Hulk, a female Thor. Alonso was part of the discussion and seemingly agreed, saying Marvel had gotten too political. We've gone through a period where in pop culture as a whole, and you guys notice this as much as we do, he said, there's been this massive discussion about inclusion and diversity, but Marvel is not about politics. Cebulski on the other hand, to get back to him, has always been entrenched in Marvel's attempts to include heroes of diverse backgrounds. He began his career in manga and worked on the Marvel mangaverse in the early 2000s. He also worked on the Runaways spinoff Loners, overseeing Nico Minoru's storyline in the series Mystic Arcana. His promotion has left many Marvel fans cautiously optimistic. Time will tell how Marvel will look under Cebulski's leadership, but when Bleeding Cool inquired about the new position, Cebulski could hardly contain his excitement. I've been at Marvel for 15 years now, but I've been with Marvel for 40. I live and breathe our characters and stories. Cut me and I don't bleed red, I bleed Marvel red, is what Cebulski said.
That was part of his job interview, I believe.
So that's huge news.
That is really big.
That's absolutely huge news. My thought about that is that I personally did not care for Alonso's tenure at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't because of the diversity, because I actually am super excited that Cebulski is coming in. My biggest fear for Marvel is that they were turning away from diversity because they thought that that was the problem with their lower sales.
Yeah, they were reading the tea leaves.
They were reading them wrong.
Much.
The problem with Marvel's books is that they weren't good.
Yeah.
They weren't telling good stories. They had a rotating crew of artists on just about every book, so you could not get into a groove with book. They were doing that thing that we have talked about hating for years, which is you hire superstar teams and they do three issues and then they move on to something else. There was no consistency.
Yep.
There felt like there was no cohesive vision for the Marvel Universe. And so that was the problem. And I think that Cebulski will address that. Here's the thing about C.B. Cebulski. In the 12 years that we have done this show, I have heard nothing but positive about C.B. Cebulski. We've seen him a couple times at shows.
Yep.
We've seen the fact that he's been doing sort of the global talent search thing for the past few years, I think speaks really hopeful about what we can kind of expect from Marvel in the future. I think he's going to bring an infusion of new talent into Marvel. We've been seeing a lot of the same names over and over and over again. I think that's going to change now. It's going to change anyways with Bendis leaving, but I think it's also going to change now with that sort of second tier of Marvel names that we've been seeing for the past decade or so. I think this is going to be a big shakeup at Marvel, and that is absolutely huge news. So I'm very optimistic about the change from Axel Alonso to C.B. Cebulski.
Yeah, and Axel was that guy that when he went in, he went from DC, where was he over? He was doing, I can't even think, their adult imprint. What was the?
Was it Marvel Knights?
No, for DC.
For DC, was it?
Vertigo. So he was the Vertigo guy for a while. And then all of a sudden ended up over there. And it was a very quiet on the outside relationship. Like you never heard a lot. He wasn't, you know, where you had Joe Quesada, who was like the fans guy. He was there all the time talking to everybody, kind of carrying the Stan Lee mode of P.T. Barnum always talking, always selling.
Yes.
Axel was a lot quieter. I don't even think I've ever even seen the guy.
Well, the other thing, too, is I think you hit the nail on the head. One of the biggest challenges that Axel faced coming in is that he wasn't Joe Quesada.
Yeah.
And so you went from this guy who was out there, who was a personality in the face of Marvel and was always speaking with enthusiasm about their books and that kind of stuff and interacting with fans and everything, to someone who wasn't. I think you couple that with the fact that during, let's say, 2011, this happened. This is when comics journalism started to change as well.
Yeah.
When you, again, go to Comic Book Resources Today. This is a site that I used to work for that I have an undying love for. When Jonah sold that site, when he left Comic Book Resources, it basically turned into BuzzFeed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's top 10 list. It's like the middle section of Wizard Magazine now. And that, unfortunately, is what a lot of comic book sites have become, and a lot of video game sites and a lot of news sites
as well.
In general. Absolutely, because that's what gets clicks. It's shorter content. It's designed to grab people with list-based content and things like that. But what you lose in that is you lose the deeper features, and you lose the in-depth discussion, and you lose a lot of that interactivity. And there was a time over on Marvel where there was it the Cup of Joe thing that they were doing on a regular basis over at Comic Book Resources, where, you know, there was, and some of that happened with Axel, and then it kind of fell off after a while. And so I think that was one of the big things, is he had big shoes to fill coming in. It was sort of a mixed bag with him over the years. And I think now that Cebulski is coming in, they can learn lessons from the time that Axel was there. But about Joe Quesada, Matthew, let's dive into this. This came over from The Beat, which, by the way, as I mentioned, comics news sites, Heidi McDonald over at The Beat is still doing what I believe, and in my reading of it on a regular basis, is the best comics journalism that is still occurring in comics news today. So if you take one thing away from this final episode of Secret Identity, go support The Beat. Heidi is excellent. That's where I go first for all my news now. Over on The Beat, she writes, back in 2011, Axel Alonso was named editor-in-chief of Marvel. I reached out to Marvel to do an entry interview, and the wish was granted, perhaps because I knew Axel from us working together. The interview is, as far as I know, one of only a handful of free, open, non-event-focused interviews that Alonso did in the whole time he was editor-in-chief. I enjoy an equally collegial relationship with C.B. Cebulski, Marvel's new editor-in-chief, but I didn't even bother reaching out. Such access as I enjoyed in 2011 is unthinkable now.
Yeah.
Which is what we just talked about. In 2011, there was no social media, and it did not have the supremacy that it has now, and an interview with an online website was just a side note to the main business. Now, to quote Rachel in Blade Runner, it is the business. And so we learn that CB will settle into his new role before being set loose in the world for interviews. Instead, Marvel's chief creative officer and former EIC, Joe Quesada, has been called in, Mr. Wolf style, to smooth the transition and frame it for the news outlets. So this is interesting. She's talking about the fact that as CB comes in and gets his feet under him as the new editor-in-chief, it is Joe Quesada who will be the face of this process, and he will help that transition happen. She goes on to say, the first sign of this is an interview at Newsarama that sets up the next few months very nicely and reveals what a diplomat Quesada is, from thanking Alonso for reigning over the most profitable period in Marvel's history, which is true, to setting up the CB years. And Joe Quesada says, CB's reputation among creators and our staff is top-notch. They love him so much. Of this game is talent relations. I came in with a lucky advantage in that I had knowledge from both sides of the desk. I understood what it was like to be talent in need of management and could also see from the other side, driving creative and helping talent with their stories and their dreams. And this is one of the big reasons CB was hired back in the day. I saw so much of that exact same thing in him. He truly cares about the people he works for and the work that they produce. That's an important part of being EIC, getting the talent to know that you genuinely care, and more importantly, that they can trust you. CB is a creative guy to begin with and has a great eye for talent. He's done every aspect of the job and has always been an amazing advocate for Marvel. Now as the editor-in-chief, he's now the face of our publishing division, and that face is a big part of the job as well. He always had a good public and private persona, and again, creators adore him. He's one of my dearest friends, so selfishly speaking, one of the things that gives me great joy about his new job is that we get him back in New York. That was Heidi saying that. Quesada also reveals that he'll be taking a more hands-on approach with editorial to smooth the transition. And Joe says again, I've already talked to some of the guys at Marvel and told them I want to shift more of my focus so I can do a little bit more in publishing. And I want to be there to help CB land with both feet running and be there for him in any way he needs me to be. So yeah, it was around early October that I started to shift my focus a bit. We have a young editorial crew, and these kids are super bright and eager to learn as much about Marvel and the industry as possible. So I started doing a few seminars on covers, design, pacing, etc. It's been a blast getting back into the trenches. So that is really, to me, one of the bigger pieces of this news, is that Quesada, who has sort of been outside of publishing for a while, is coming back in order to
make the transition.
Basically
smooth.
Make the transition. Yeah. And also be the guy who can speak to the comic outlets and be the guy who can speak to the press to make sure that Marvel stays on message as CB transitions into this role and make sure that he puts his best foot forward. And I think that's very smart on Marvel's part. I mean, to me, what this equates to is that it's all hands on deck.
Yes.
There are big creative changes going on here. They just lost one of their major story architects over the past however many years that Bendis was there. They have a new editor-in-chief. What better way to try to ease people's minds and make that the most positive transition possible than have Joe Quesada come back and be that carnival barker and be that guy who can sort of take the media attention and channel it in the right direction as CB comes in. So this is monumental for Marvel. And they're at a spot right now where their comic book world is not in a great place.
Yeah, when Axel came in, Marvel was on top. And now with CB coming in, they're kind of in a free fall. And they, again, we've talked about they've had a lot of things. Like with Legacy, I am loving what Legacy is doing, but I'm the guy on the outside that other than Captain America, I wasn't reading very much Marvel. Now I'm reading, I think, 5 or 6 books because of the Legacy, the way that they're doing it and what they're doing. But it has really been tough to watch kind of Marvel skid. Even though I'm a DC guy, it's been kind of tough to watch a lot of those projects fall apart. But one of the things about CB that I want to mention is I have a friend who is the guy who puts together the Puerto Rico Comic Con. And every year he always says, hey, do you want to come down? Do you want to, you know, do your book thing? And he'll tell me the guest, and CB's always there. And like 2 years in, I remember asking him, I'm like, you know, CB's kind of just like the portfolio guy. You know, how busy is he actually? He said he's the busiest guy there. And everybody loves him. He is a down-to-earth guy. Talking about his past, he's an incredible judge of character. He's a great judge of talent. So there's a lot of people at Marvel now that are probably there because of him and him bringing him in. So that is going to help him in what he's trying to do. I sort of liken it to, you always used to have like at UPS. I mean, I don't know if this is at every job, but at UPS, I used to always have a serious loyalty to the HR guy who hired me. So the HR guy walked in the building. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's, you know, it's like I'm throwing rose petals down for this guy because he gave me my opportunity.
Sure.
And I would see him and he could come up and say, you know, you really suck. You need to pick it up. And I would be like, oh my gosh, for you, I don't want to disappoint
you,
Peter.
I'll
do anything. Yeah. And I imagine a lot of guys there are like that. And I know that Axel's, you know, there were some troubles in certain areas and things like that, but I think CB is just going to make it more of the fun creative. He's the player's coach right now.
Yeah.
Right after you just got rid of Bill Parcells, you now have, you know, Goofy Johnson who's coaching. Not that he's goofy at all, but I think you're going to see a completely relaxed atmosphere. And I think this is going to be good for him.
I expect at San Diego Comic-Con this summer, if not sooner, for you to start hearing about some big talent acquisitions on the part of Marvel.
Yep.
And not just maybe luring a couple people over from DC, but I think some people that might be new to the spotlight that you'll be seeing around that. I just want to see, and hopefully I'm sure that Quesada and Cebulski and the Marvel leadership have had a lot of conversations about the current state of the Marvel comic universe and where they need to go with this. Legacy is just starting.
Yep.
So we haven't really gotten an exact feel for what it can be yet, which on the positive side means that it's flexible. Like they still have time to make Legacy a success. Legacy has not hit with the positive reaction that Rebirth hit with.
Yeah.
With Rebirth, we felt like, wow, okay, DC has found their vision again for these characters, and it feels like it's right. It feels like this is a good fit. It feels like we're moving in the right direction here. Marvel's did not. That's what it was supposed to be for.
Yes.
Marvel, I think, in our eyes, was like, okay, so Legacy is sort of Marvel's kind of soft reset where they come in and say, let's make sure we have these characters right. Let's make sure we have these books right. And it just hasn't hit with the same. You talked about it here on the show, but I have since read Legacy #1, very disappointed in it.
Yeah.
I did not think that hit.
There were
all
moments. That was the thing. It was almost like a collection of ads.
Yep.
Which I knew what it was going to be that going in. And getting it's like, okay, well, oh my gosh, I got 2 pages of Ben and Johnny talking about getting the team back together. And that was, to me, that was the big win in that.
Yeah. So it's, they're in need of some creative vision for sure. And so these are absolutely huge changes. To go back to the DC side of things, them getting, I feel like from a creative vision standpoint, like they've established Rebirth, they've established these books, they have a lot of their core characters in a very good place, and then they just added Brian Michael Bendis. So he doesn't have the pressure of coming in and having to quote-unquote fix a broken comic book universe or, you know, get DC to a place where their creative landscape is in a good place. They now have this amazing weapon at their disposal.
Yeah.
And they can choose to use him however they'd like. There's no pressure on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would expect from Bendis over at DC that you would see him working on a pretty major title in the near future, but also working on bringing new characters into the DC universe. That is kind of where I'm sure they've had conversations about, like, you know, you've created some amazing characters over at Marvel. We want you to create, you know, the next, help create the next wave of amazing characters over at DC. Because what DC has is they have, to take a word out of Marvel, they have that legacy.
They have the legacy right
there. They have those characters. He doesn't need to establish them. He can just stay true to them and come in and work on them. But they're going to need him to bring in some new characters that people can get excited about as well, because DC has done a great job now of pulling back in their core traditional readership, but they also have to continue to widen their audience.
Yep.
And so, but man, from DC standpoint, they have really started to put their chessboard together with creative talent and editorial talent, and to kind of put themselves in a really good position.
Considering a few years ago when Charles Soule was the kind of the hot guy at DC, and all of a sudden they pulled him, Marvel got him, and I remember thinking that was it. It's all over. That they're never going to be able to get that one guy that can sort of be the visionary, the big name, and now they got him. So that's good.
I know our buddy Daryl probably does not want to hear this, but the guy that I see them making a play for, and I believe he's exclusive now to DC when his deal is up, is Tom King.
Yeah.
Because he did write Vision for Marvel, which was one of the more critically well-received books in a long time. But I believe he is exclusive to DC now.
I don't know if he is or not.
But I would not be surprised to see Marvel make a big play to make him exclusive over at Marvel at some point. Because they see him – I see him as kind of like an architect guy. Like he's – like right now he's come in on – a book in Batman where he had gigantic shoes to fill, and he's filled them amazingly well. So he's proved himself on DC's biggest spotlight book. That's a guy that – that's a move that earns you kind of like the bookmark of someone to watch. You know what I mean? So that kind of thing. So yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, my hope is that Marvel and DC are both healthy from a comic book standpoint, and that this drives both of them to write the best stories that they can possibly write. And again, with all this shifting and all this changing with the big two, this also opens the door for all of the other publishers to continue to make their moves and continue to make their push and continue to grab a little bit more of that market share. So it's an interesting time.
Yep, it is.
It's going to be interesting to watch. So that was half an hour of news.
There we go. Perfect.
A half hour of news. So I think it's about time that we actually start talking about some comics. But before we do, let's talk about beard products. Let me tell you the nightmare world that I'm living in now, Matthew.
You have written your own commercial.
Everyone here knows that we've been talking about Viking oils for the past couple years now on Secret Identity. And that when it comes to beard products, I use them very, very regularly. And every time your facial hair grows in, which it has again, you are using the beard balm from Viking oils. So I went on this trip to California and I came back, and the one thing that I was looking forward to when I got home, because I didn't bring the beard oil with me, because you can't take the liquids when – I don't know if you're allowed to take them in checked bags or not, but you're not allowed to take them in carry-ons or anything like that. Plus, I don't want to put something in my suitcase that could potentially break and ruin stuff, so I left it at home. That was a bad decision. Because by the time I got home, I was getting the beard dandruff and everything and all that kind of stuff. So one of the things legitimately that I was looking forward to when I got home is like, oh, I could start getting my beard back in shape. It's gone. And all of a sudden, the usual suspects around my house, no one's admitting to where this stuff has gone. I said, where's my little blue bottle of beard oil? Oh, I don't know. If it was in the bathroom, then it should still be in the bathroom. Well, it's clearly not. And I've looked all over the place. So my daughter let slip the other day that my wife may have thrown it away in one of her cleaning, fits where she on a dime decides that our house is just a dumpster and that everybody is worthless and no one does anything around here. And so she goes on this – I like to call it the chornado.
I like that.
And what I tell the kids is like, don't get caught in the chornado. So when you see that look in mom's eye, you have to make sure that you are actively doing something. Whether it be making your bed or putting the dishes away or whatever, because if that eye turns toward you, it's like the eye of Sauron in Lord of the Rings. If it turns to you and you're not doing anything, you will immediately be given 5 to 6 tasks to do right now. And we refer to that as the chornado. And so as much as I like to warn the kids, they don't heed my warnings and then they get caught up in the chornado and there's their afternoon. It's gone. Yep. So when that happens, things get thrown away. things get put away that you'll never see them again, because at that point she just sees red. And so,
in this case, she saw blue bottles.
In this case, she saw blue, and I believe she threw away my beard oil. So I'm very disheartened about that. I'm in the process of getting more beard oil. So, don't live in the nightmare world that I had to live in this week, Matthew. Go to VikingOilsLLC.com. Get yourself some quality beard products, as the weather has taken a turn for the frigid, because
yes,
that means dry skin underneath that beard. So there you go. I had a story to share for our last Viking Oils ad in the show.
You did.
And now that brings us to comic books. And I'm going to start us off today, Matthew. I went back to my roots, you know?
You did.
I did. I said, it's the last show. What are the books that I'm going to continue to read, even though we're not doing Secret Identity anymore? What are the books that I'm always going to read? Spider-Man.
Yes.
I'm always going to read Spider-Man.
And I like the cover.
And what's interesting about this book is that this is not the Dan Slott Spider-Man that we're talking about. This is my favorite character, and what you see is almost a Norman Rockwell-esque cover on the front of Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man, number 6. Now, this is pre-legacy numbering. This is how far behind I am in my books. But I wanted to talk about this issue because it is all about J. Jonah Jameson and Spider-Man. So it just felt right. Now, Spectacular Spider-Man, what's been happening in that book is that Peter Parker has a woman in his life who may or may not be his long-lost sister. There was a book called Family Business, which I want to say was written by Mark Waid. And it introduced a character called Teresa Durand, who at the time was known as Teresa Parker. And she was ex-CIA, but she was this agent who believed that she was Peter Parker's long-lost sister. And what they found out through the course of the story is that she had been tricked into believing that. But as the story wrapped up, and it was a one-shot graphic novel, there was a hint to the notion that actually she might be Peter Parker's sister. And so she has shown up in this book, because what's happening in this book is that the Tinkerer has a brother named the Mason, codenamed the Mason. And while the Tinkerer makes equipment and suits for bad guys, the Mason does that for superheroes. Now, there is a part of S.H.I.E.L.D., a division called the Gray Blade, that had been compiling information on both superheroes and supervillains about their technology and their powers and how to defeat them. And this Teresa was a part of this S.H.I.E.L.D. unit. But when she found out they were doing this, she left. And she erased all of their data, and now they're after her because there was a lot of information that could be very detrimental to superheroes and supervillains, but certainly superheroes as well. So Peter Parker is trying to get to the bottom of this because his potential sister is in danger. And even if she's not his sister, they've now formed a relationship and he cares about her and stuff like that. And so you have J. Jonah Jameson, who's been working on a story that he's just starting to put the pieces together about, that this information has been taken from both the Tinkerer and from the Mason. Someone is taking information from these two and giving it to this Rogue S.H.I.E.L.D. unit. And Peter Parker reached out to J. Jonah Jameson, and Jameson said, I will tell you everything I know about this story that I've been working on, but I want a sit-down interview with Spider-Man in order to grant that information to you. So Peter arranges this to happen, and the title of this issue is called My Dinner with Jonah. And it is about Spider-Man sitting down to dinner with J. Jonah Jameson and agreeing to do an exclusive interview with him in exchange for this information. And Jameson now, who was once the head of the Bugle and also was the mayor, is now a blogger. Because this is how far he's followed. He is a blogger, and most of his blogs consists of blogs about Spider-Man. And I believe the website for his blog is called threatsandmenaces.com.
Nice.
And so as we start out, you have Jonah, who has made lasagna, and he is sitting across the table in his socks he's got his same Jonah Jameson outfit on that he always wears, but just in his socks because they're at his house. And Peter's dressed as Spider-Man, and he says, let's get started. And Peter's like, this is insane. I just want information about Teresa Durand. Just give me what I want so I can go. And he's saying, not a chance. You agreed to sit down to do an interview you're going to tell me what I want to know, or I'm not going to give you any of this information. And they kind of go back and forth, and then Jonah says, fine, let me share some stuff with you. And he basically says, Teresa Duran, an ex-SHIELD agent, stole classified material. An associate and I received tips that what she stole was information on how to defeat a host of so-called superheroes and supervillains. So we started working on this. The source told us the majority of the information was of a technical nature. So where did SHIELD get that? What was the easiest, most logical place? And this is something that Peter hasn't put together yet, but as they're talking about it, Peter realizes, holy crap, it's all the Tinkerer. The Tinkerer is the one behind this. He is selling the information that he has on supervillains, and he stole the information from his own brother about superheroes, and he's selling that to SHIELD as well. And so Peter's like, holy crap, I didn't even think about that. And he's like, okay, well, I got to get started on investigating this. And Jonah's like, no, you need to sit down and do this interview now. And Peter's like, fine, okay, I did agree to that. So the first question Jonah has for him is, who are you? And Peter's like, nice try. And they're going back and forth. And where the heart and soul of this issue lies is because they go back and forth for a couple of pages is that you have them sort of reliving moments in their history and why Jonah hates Spider-Man. Why does he have it out for Spider-Man so much? He blames Spider-Man for the death of his wife, for not being able to save her, even though Spider-Man always talks about saving people. And this is what he does. He does for a good thing. And he blames Spider-Man for wearing a mask because he said that at one point in his life he was mugged. And he was mugged by a guy in a mask. And all he could keep thinking about as he was being mugged from this guy is, what a coward you are to be wearing a mask. And so he's always associated people who wear a mask as cowards, even though, you know, Pete is saying, look, I wear a mask because I need to protect my loved ones and stuff like that. And so they keep going back and forth. And, you know, Peter's saying, you hired the whole Spider Slayer group to basically kill me. Like, you're an awful person. And all you've ever done was try to get in the way of me being able to help people. And Jonah's basically saying, you're a fraud and you're a coward and you don't save all the people that you talk about saving. You couldn't save my wife. And so, you know, he's like, I need to hold you accountable. That is my job. My job is to hold you accountable. And he's kind of screaming about it. And Peter's like, why are you so stuck up on me? Like, I don't understand that. You've spent your entire career, you know, making my life miserable. And Jonah's saying, well, you have this mask. You can't take responsibility for your actions. You don't know the first thing about responsibility. And Peter's laughing because he knows that because of Uncle Ben, like that was the hardest lesson he's ever had to learn. So at one point they're going back and forth and Peter basically says to him, you know, you have nothing in your life. You've lost your life. You've lost your job. He's like, I help people. You help no one. You're worthless. You've wasted your life. You've got nothing except your stupid vendetta against me. And you see Jonah kind of realizing that, yeah, he doesn't have the bugle anymore. His wife is not around anymore. All of these things that he's put his whole life around, none of them exist. And he starts bawling. And Peter's like, holy crap, I didn't mean to kind of do that. And you see Jonah is just a completely broken man. He's like, My father's dead. My daughter is dead. The bugle, the only thing worth a damn in this world, has rejected me. My wife is dead. He's like, you're right. I don't have anything left. And he kind of just breaks down and he tells Spidey to get out. And he's like, I'm completely alone. I've got nothing. He's like, you win, Spider-Man. You're absolutely right. I have absolutely nothing. And he's like, just get out of here. And Pete's like, I'm tired of this game. It's gone on too long. And your family. He's like, you think that nobody cares about you. I care about you. And he takes off his mask and he shows J. Jonah Jameson who he actually is.
Get out.
Because for those that haven't been reading Spider-Man, Aunt May was married to J. Jameson,
yes,
who is Jonah's father. And he recently died in the whole kind of new you thing. And so Peter shows him who he is. And he's like, is this some sort of joke? And Pete's like, nope, it's no joke. You know, on my Aunt May, you know, because of her, I could never lie and all this kind of stuff. So they kind of have this moment of reconciliation. And all of a sudden, Peter looks over at Jonah's computer and sees that Jonah announced that he was going to be interviewing Spider-Man tonight on his blog. And he's like, holy crap, did you tell people that I was going to be here? And he's like, yeah, well, I was just promoting the interview. And all of a sudden, there's a knock on the door because the SWAT team has shown up because Spidey is now wanted in connection to this SHIELD situation that's going on. And so he has to basically get out of there. But Jonah now knows who Peter Parker is, which when you think about the magnitude of that.
Yeah, that's huge.
And by the way, the creative team here, Chip Zdarsky is the writer, Michael Walsh is the artist, Ian Herring on colors, and Travis Lanham on letters, and the editor was Nick Lowe on this one. But when you think about the ramifications of that for Spider-Man's universe, I mean, that's huge. But what I liked about this issue is that it started off extremely antagonistic. And really, Spidey was almost coming off as the bigger jerk here, and he did push Jonah to the point of breaking, to the point of admitting, basically, that he has nothing in his life except this vendetta that he has against Spider-Man. Everything else has been taken away from him. And so for Pete to then come to him and confide in him, this guy who believes that he has absolutely nothing left in the world, was a huge moment. And it's a moment that I hope they don't take away, and it's a moment that I hope that they choose to build on, because this book is not happening completely separate from Dan Slott's Spider-Man. They are happening in the same world. The books are tied together. I hope that they choose to build on this, because that completely redefines J. Jonah Jameson as a character if his vendetta against Spider-Man is now either gone, or that he now has this information that he can use against Spider-Man, which creates a whole new element of that dynamic. So very, very interesting issue. I have liked this series. It definitely has its more lighthearted moments with Chip Zdarsky writing it. However, it has really brought in this Teresa character and created an interesting storyline around it. And so I am digging it. So I definitely recommend Spectacular Spider-Man if you haven't checked it out yet.
I've been picking that one up. I do like it. I like the lighthearted nature of it, that there's some serious stuff, but it's got a little bit of a humor to it.
Yeah, and it's not focused so much on the Parker Industry stuff and things like that. It's focused more on Spider-Man.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about a book that is the absolute polar opposite of the Spider-Man book that you just spoke about, and that is Doomsday Clock. This is a book that is very, very, very much a depressing, upsetting, and very earth-shattering issue. This is going to be a massive series. But for me, it was interesting because I was somebody that did not like The Watchmen when it came out. I did not like the fact that it was, oh, great, now we're going to start making serious comic books. Good thing this isn't going to last. And I was a little off on that one.
Sure.
Because Watchmen definitely turned the tide of how comic books were written, how they were drawn, and how they were perceived by people. But on this one, Geoff Johns is the writer. Gary Frank is the illustrator. Brad Anderson is the colorist. And it's funny because that this was hinted at maybe 3 or 4 months ago. Haven't really thought much about it. You started seeing a couple ads here and there. But then when I went to the store this week and saw it, I completely forgot all about it. So obviously purchased it. There were 6 or 7 different covers. I got the Superman being ripped apart by clock gears.
Can I just tell you what my hopes and fears are about this series?
Yes.
We just talked a few minutes ago about how, and I did order this, I haven't read it yet, but we just talked a little while ago about how Rebirth feels right. How it feels like, yes, DC is in a good place right now in terms of the creativity in their comics and the storylines and in the current universe. My biggest fear is that this was one of the more interesting mysteries of Rebirth, and I feel like we're getting to it too quickly. I'm a little worried that we're solving this mystery this early in the Rebirth era. So my fear is that it could negatively affect the great place that the DC comic book universe is in right now. That's my fear.
So I mean, the first issue, it doesn't give you a ton of where it's going to go. I mean, this is 12 issues, and I will tell you, this book is dense when it comes to reading. It took me, which is great. It's a $5.99 book, or $4.99 book, $5.99 if you get the lenticular cover.
So without getting into that, like going into this book, what was your, knowing that the Watchmen have a connection to this universe, what was your theory? What was your going theory of like what the connection is?
Interesting that I never really even had one.
Okay.
I never had a theory about it. I never thought much about it. Again, because I wasn't into The Watchmen. So The Watchmen happened in a completely different world than what we're having and what we're seeing. But this could easily be sort of an Earth 2 kind of situation.
See, that was my thing, is that my thought was Dr. Manhattan is responsible for the current status of the DC comic book universe. And because of that, it can all be undone.
Yeah.
That's my fear. My hope is that it's much deeper than that, and that it can't be undone. That's my hope.
So we are starting out November 22nd, 1992.
Okay.
So we are going back a ways. And it's starting with a protest of the end is near. You've got the Russian – it's the Russian-United States aggression. This is before the wall came down. All sorts of craziness is still going on. And they're talking about the fact that the Russians have now just invaded Poland. They're in Belarus, and they are threatening to enter. They're doing all sorts of crazy stuff. So there is the fear that that threat we grew up with in the 80s of nuclear war is right back here. You've got people protesting, and these protests now are starting to get violent. I will tell you this, and I know I'm in agreement, or people are in agreement with me. Gary Frank is amazing.
Agreed. I'm in agreement with you.
He is absolutely amazing. Now, the whole point of The Watchmen, how it all got started, because there's a lot of this kind of in here, is the fact that when DC bought the Charlton characters in about 1985, 1986, The Watchmen was sort of a – that they were going to use characters that they weren't going to use normally and regularly, and they were going to create – the Watchmen story was going to be about these guys. So when you look at – or I'm sorry, when you look at it, it was going to be like the – I'm trying to go through some of the characters, but basically the comedian was the Sage. I won't even go through all that stuff right now. But they were going to use those characters.
Rorschach was the question, right?
Rorschach was the question. Yeah. So they were going to go through that. They were going to use those Charlton characters.
Yep.
And the Beetle was the Owl.
Right.
So you had all that, and that was what they were going to do, and they were going to kind of end it. But DC said, wait a minute. We got some characters with some legs. We want to use Blue Beetle. We want to use Captain Atom. Captain Atom was Dr. Midnight. Was it Dr. Midnight?
Manhattan.
Dr. Manhattan. So they said, you know what, why don't we just create a whole bunch of characters, tell this whole story that we've already got. So that was where The Watchmen came from. And all you have in this entire thing is people really starting to struggle with what is going on right now, with what's happening in this world. You've got everybody that's starting to fall apart. People are looking for their heroes. But if you know how The Watchmen ended, all the heroes ended up – it just fell apart.
Yeah.
You saw that their heroes were not necessarily heroes at all. They were flawed human beings. And even you had like the Owl and the Silk Spectre, who were probably the two of the more normal ones, still had their issues that they were trying to deal with.
Have I mentioned how much I like the Watchmen movie?
And I love the Watchmen movie.
It's my favorite Zack Snyder movie.
I think that movie is great. It made me kind of like the Watchmen a little bit.
Me too.
So where this story gets really good is when they go in there, and I'm already forgetting the guy's name, the guy who was sort of the head of it, Ozymandias. Ozymandias, who was sort of the god. He was like a Greek god just living in modern times.
He was the manipulator behind everything.
He has lost everything. And once he fell, everything started to fall. And that's kind of what's going on right now. It basically, like where I was thinking about you in this, is that this was the guy that was keeping the Lovecraft world from coming into our world and destroying everything. So he was the guy that kept everything away, gave the world that false sense of hope and security, and now that he's no longer here.
This is Dr. Manhattan that you're talking about.
No, this guy, the Ozymandias.
Because Ozymandias was the bad guy in
this. He was the guy, like he was the big businessman.
Yeah, he was the one who masterminded the plan that basically manipulated everybody else on his team and was manipulating mankind, whereas Dr. Manhattan was the one who has the reality-bending powers. I remember correctly.
And Dr. Manhattan has been gone for a while.
Okay.
He's not even – people talk about him a little bit in the shadows.
That was my one gripe, by the way, about the Watchmen movie is the Lovecraft stuff not being in it.
Yes.
That was my big
– So – and it was funny because as I was mentioning that, I'm like, wait a minute. Was that in the comic or in the movie? But it was in the comic because they didn't have the big Kraken show up and the big fight. So this to me is where the story gets really, really good. As the world is falling apart – you've got a scene in a prison where a guard is walking by and a guy grabs him and he's like, get me the keys, get me out of here. And he punches him and he opens up the door. He's going to go grab the keys. And when he goes to grab the keys, Rorschach is there. And Rorschach looks up and he goes, you still want out? And the guy's like, no, man, I'm cool. I'm cool myself. Thank you. So as Rorschach is walking through, he's talking about what is going on. He's like, oh, man, this is ridiculous. I can't believe the world is going to end right now, and I've got to do something I don't really want to do. So he's trying to find a prisoner. He has to release a prisoner who can help save the situation. And as he's walking through, he's like, maybe the 13th floor, because he doesn't know where she is. He's like, 13th floor sounds like it would be where she would be. Now, you know what? Maybe I know there's a number system, so it's got to be 31. So he goes upstairs, and it's great because with Rorschach, the word bubbles or the thought bubbles show the complete insanity in his brain processing. Like, you just see how everything's going on because
they're almost like journal entries,
yeah,
right? Because
he's not the most sane guy in the world. And he finally gets up there, and as he's going in there trying to find the right thing, he's opening up prison doors, cell doors. You see the launch key guys have their keys in, ready to basically start the end of the world. And the Rorschach opens up, and he's looking for Erica Mason or Manson, the marionette. And she looks over and she's like, Rorschach. And he's like, yeah, I need you to get out of here. You're going to help me fix this problem that's going on right now. And she's like, I ain't going to fix it. I ain't going with you. And he goes, well, if you want your kid back alive, you will do this. So she's like, oh my gosh. So she realizes that the guy basically who put her in jail is now going to get her out and may or may not actually have control over her child. So he's like, okay, well, you don't believe me. Here's a picture, and shows her the picture, and the woman's like, okay, let's get out of here. Let's get out of here. But before she does, she throws him up against the wall, starts choking him, and says, where's my son? Where's my son? He goes, look, I don't know where your son is, but I do know where he is. All I need to let you know is we need to get out of here right now. And she goes, all right, but if I'm leaving right now, a baby needs his daddy, so we got to get my husband out of here. And he's like, oh, come on. Are you kidding me? She's like, yep, we got to get my husband. Meanwhile, full bore prison riot has escalated. Every prisoner is out. They're beating up guards. They walk into a cell, and there's a guy just sitting there staring. And you find out later on that his name is the Mime. Now, do you remember in this – did you read the Justice League Suicide Squad?
No.
There was a team in there that was – it almost looked like it's kind of alluding that these were those guys.
Okay.
That this was – so you're seeing like – these characters may have been elsewhere in the DC universe. But what is super cool about this is that this guy's name is the Mime. And they put him in the cell and they're like, you know what? We don't like the way he stares at us all the time. Let's take it out on him. So they start beating the crap out of him. He's letting them beat him up. He's got this smile on his face. It's cool because he's got this black hair with this big shock of white down the middle. When you think of a mime, you think of the black and white striped shirts. He's got that in his hair. So all of a sudden, Rorschach and the woman show up and say, baby, letting you know we're leaving now as her husband's getting beat up. And he gives a little look, and she's like, yeah, you know what? Don't worry about this. This is just one of his performances. And Rorschach's like, what do you mean a performance? And all of a sudden, he goes nuts, grabs one of the guys who was beating him up, jams his face into the bars of the prison. You see teeth and blood going everywhere. There's like 9 or 10 guys that you just see getting dismantled, literally. And he's got this look on his face, and I'll show you, Brian, because it is freaking priceless. You see the look on his face as he's walking out, sees his wife, and as they're getting ready to leave, he does some mime thing, and she goes, you're right, baby. We need to get your equipment. And he goes, so we need to go somewhere else to go get his gear. And she's like, what are you talking about his gear? Rorschach's like, we got to get out of here. And he's like, well, look, he ain't leaving without his gear. So they go into like a locker, and he opens up the locker. The locker is empty. There's nothing in it. And he reaches in and he mimes and puts stuff on. He puts like a belt on, and he puts something over his shoulders. And Rorschach, it's just question marks. And he looks over, and then you see him like put up a tie. And he looks at he goes, you two have big problems. So they finally get out of the cell. And my whole thing on this one was, is there something there or is there not something there? That I thought was absolutely brilliant, where in the 8 or 9 pages of death, blood, and destruction,
yep,
you've got this really funny moment where I'm like, this has now become the big mystery for me. Is it real? Is the stuff real? I mean, that's probably not what they were looking for. So they get in there. They get the car. They get in a car. They start escaping. And as they're talking, Rorschach is explaining that right now the world is going to fall apart. The world powers are ready to blow everything out, and we need to take care of this because the heroes aren't here anymore. And as he starts going through, they start walking through. You see a danger flood door. He knocks on it. He opens up. They go walking through, and as they come through, it's sort of like his headquarters. And they're looking around. The couple's like, oh my gosh, this is great. And as they start going through all the stuff and looking around, and they see that it is basically the old headquarters of the Watchmen. And they see the owl's costume, and she's like, oh, is the owl going to be here? Yeah, I haven't heard from him in a long while. Then all of a sudden, Ozymandias walks out and says, hey guys, here we are. I'm working with Rorschach, you know, and hopefully we're going to get this. So they start freaking out, and they're like, you know, this is all your fault. And he goes, hey, you know what? I just need to be truthful right now. I'm the one who has your kid, and we need to fix this problem that's going on. And she says to him something about, she gets a screwdriver and is ready to throw it at him, right into his face. And she's like, what's the price on your head anyway? $20 million to find you dead or alive? And he's like, well, it probably should be more than that. But right now, I'm happy to pay. I'll pay you that if you just let me live and we can fix this problem right now. And the great thing too about Rorschach's mask, every time he's talking, you see the face
changes, yeah,
shifting, and it's really creepy. And then he's being completely, he's got that red pet that he always had, that like alien looking cat,
yep,
that he always carried. And he's being completely smug about the whole thing because he's explaining, yeah, I know the situation, but it's all on me. I'm the one that's got to do this. I'm the only one. And he's not necessarily seeming to want to save the world to save the world. He wants to save it to get his piece of the pie back. He wants his empire back. He wants everything that he built. And you see that he's a little upset. And you also see that he's sick. And they almost start to allude. Oh, they don't start to allude. They do, where he starts having a headache and really getting upset and sick. And he walks away, and the woman goes, what's wrong with him? And Rorschach goes, he's an a-hole. And he goes, well, yes, but I also have cancer. So he has cancer. He is saying that he got the cancer from the time that he spent with
Dr. Manhattan.
Much like the woman that he – like the first woman that he was with.
I think so, yeah.
She had cancer and died. So you're seeing that he might have had that. And he starts explaining that basically this is who they are looking for, and that his essence is here on Earth. Because you see the blue wording in one part of this where they're talking, you know, he's like, yeah, Dr. Manhattan. And she goes, no one's seen him for years. He goes, yes, I know. I'm leaving this galaxy for one less complicated. And you're seeing his final words, and he goes, that was our mission. He goes, we need to find him. And now you kind of tie into the world of DC, where you've got Clark and Lois that are sleeping, and he's thinking back to the accident that killed his parents. And they had a car accident coming back from dropping him off at like his prom or something, which I don't know if that's part of the new lexicon of Superman, because it was really interesting. As far as I knew, they both died at separate times in the current way that it's going. Superman wakes up and he's completely freaking out.
Although these are the Superman and Lois from a different world.
Yes.
In the current DC universe.
So he wakes up and he's freaked out, and she's like, Clark, are you okay? And she's like, you're yelling in your room, and the room in the house was shaking. Is everything okay? And he's like, I had a dream. I was in high school. I was remembering about, I heard the tire screech, my parents dying. I saw my father grit his teeth. And she's like, it was a nightmare. Don't worry about it. And he goes, well, I don't have nightmares. And that's how this ends. So now you're seeing something is up in the world of Superman. And dedicated to Len Wein.
Nice.
But you have the whole thing in here that kind of gives you some newspaper headings about everything, the great lie about the Watchmen, all these things that go on. And then you get a cover gallery of all the crazy stuff. So one of the interesting things that I noticed was you have a cover of one of the issues that has the Joker, and he's putting on his makeup. And I've seen the color version of this too. That may not be the Joker. That may be this mime guy.
Oh, okay.
Because if you know and remember, they've mentioned and alluded to, there's like three or four Jokers. If you remember in the DC Rebirth one-off, there was like these three or four different Jokers that were walking around, and they're trying to explain, how do we get all these Jokers?
Yeah.
He probably is going to be one of them.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So, interesting book. Really good read. It's deep. It's thick. After you read it, you're going to be exhausted. You're going to want to read it again, because I read it twice. I haven't read anything else this weekend so far.
Yeah, I mean, my hope, and again, it's Geoff Johns.
Yep.
Like, I have faith in Geoff Johns. So my hope is that it's going to be a mystery that is not fully revealed through,
yes,
this event. And that connection is something that they can sort of explore for years without sort of resetting anything.
What you're going to like about this is that, to me, this created – my only question was how the worlds were connected.
Yeah.
Now I've got a million more other questions.
Sure.
Which is great for a first issue.
Cool. Well, we're going to jump back to Marvel and talk about Venom. Because, again, sticking with my sort of Spidey theme for the day, Eddie Brock is back in Venom – back with the Venom symbiote. And we are talking about issue number 151, which is the start of a new storyline called The Land Before Crime. I do like that as part of their legacy event, Marvel is bringing back the cover copy mm-hmm. on covers now, where you have them speaking more about the start and conclusion of story arcs, and it's more old school comic booky.
Yes.
I kind of like that. And so this one here starts off with, I think we talked about the last issue of Venom on this show, where Eddie Brock ended up, the symbiote turned on a priest that was trying to help Eddie. It was trying to talk to Eddie about the fact that if you have a corrupting influence that is affecting you, you need to get away from it. And what has happened is that since Eddie has come back with the symbiote, he's noticed that something is very different about it. He's noticing that the symbiote is almost like darker than before. And he wants to be a hero. And so he wants to do good things. And the symbiote talks about wanting to do good things too, but it's got this very dark side that it's sort of feeding into. And so he's worried that something is wrong with the symbiote. Now, as we start this one off, you have a group of film students who are in like the subway tunnels. And one of them is dressed up as the creature from the Black Lagoon. And one of them is sort of the director. So you got the camera guy, the director, the person in the costume, and then the leading lady. And they're all arguing because they're film students about like what's happening here. And the guy who is the director is being a jerk to everybody else. Like, you guys aren't listening. This is going to be crap. You know, this was my big break and all this kind of stuff. And as they're kind of arguing back and forth, you see in the shadows that there is a many-toothed grinning creature that is about to attack them all and then does so. So we end scene and we end up at the hospital where you have Eddie Brock with the priest that the symbiote had attacked. And he's seeing the priest who is like in a coma, and he's sitting by the priest's bedside, and he's saying, this should not have happened. You know, I'm sorry, Father. Since my partner and I have reunited, something's wrong. This should be perfect, and it's not perfect, and I need to figure out what's going on, and I'm going to figure out what's going on. And so as he's kind of walking out of the hospital, he overhears someone saying, it was a monster. And he turns and goes into the room, and you see the cameraman from these students that were filming, and he's the only one left of the group. Everyone else was destroyed by this monster, and he's saying it was a monster and it was in the sewers, and Eddie's going in there saying, what did it look like? I need to know, because there's part of him that's thinking, was it the symbiote? Did the symbiote go, you know, almost like either I was unconscious or the symbiote, you know, went away from me and went and did this? And so the guy's describing it, and Eddie decides, I'm going to go find out what's in the sewers, you know, hurting people. And as they're going down there, he's having this internal dialogue with the symbiote, and the symbiote saying, I know that you were relieved to realize that this wasn't me. I know that you thought it was me. You don't trust me. And Eddie's kind of saying, I don't know what to make of you right now because this feels different. And the symbiote saying, well, I don't trust you either because you were the one that originally got me trapped and I went through all this stuff and it was because of you. And so you can see that the two of them are, they're together and they want to be together, but there's some trust issues there. Well, that all goes away a couple seconds later when Venom gets attacked in the sewers by this creature that kind of looks like a dinosaur. And they end up fighting and he ends up battling this thing. And when the two of them are in battle and they're working together, like everything is fine. And he ends up, you know, beating the crap out of this thing. But as he does, he realizes that a piece of like armor that's embedded in the skin of this creature says Alchemax.
Oh.
And so he's like, oh, okay. So he webs this thing up and he ends up going to Alchemax's corporate offices. And Liz Allen, who is the wife of Harry Osborn, is, I think they're divorced now, but basically.
They're trying to get back together.
Yeah, they're trying to get back together. She's the CEO of Alchemax.
Yes.
So she's on the phone with someone saying, this is a PR nightmare. We need to figure out what's going on here. And all of a sudden, Venom shows up and he drops this webbed up creature on the floor. And he's like, is this the PR nightmare that you're talking about? Because it looks like you guys have some sort of creature running around in the sewers. And she goes on to explain, after he threatens to expose, you know, what's going on here, that what happened was there's a guy by the name of Dinosaur Man who apparently must be a longtime Marvel character, but he was like a scientist, and he was what they wanted to do was they wanted to use Kurt Connors' lizard serum to do some experiments, and so they couldn't, but they ended up getting this guy, the Dinosaur Man, and the Dinosaur Man has created a bunch of dinosaur-like creatures now, and he left with a bunch of equipment from Alchemax, and so they need to get a lid on this situation before it gets out to the public because it's going to be bad for Alchemax. And so Venom says, well, I need something from you guys. I need you to figure out what's wrong with my symbiote. And I came here because obviously you guys have the ability and the technology to be able to look into this. And so Liz basically agrees, we'll take a sample of the symbiote. We'll try to find out if there's something wrong with it. And in exchange for that, you're going to go and handle this Dinosaur Man situation for us. So that's sort of the deal that they've made. And so he ends up going to the underground caverns in the city to try and track down what he believes to be Dinosaur Man and about five or six of these creatures that he's created, except he ends up stumbling upon a cavern where there's like dozens of these things that he's created, maybe even hundreds of these things that he's created. And before he can make a retreat out of there, he gets noticed, and one of the creatures that looks like a giant pterodactyl basically screeches at him and rips the symbiote away from him because of the sonic scream. And when that happens, you see the rest of the creatures grab Eddie and they deliver him to Stegron, who is the Dinosaur Man.
Stegron.
And Stegron saying, you know, bring him forward. You see what the mammals do, how they slink and spy. They are not proud and bold as we. They do not have thunder in their lungs. They do not belong in this new world that we're creating, the world that Stegron, the Dinosaur Man, will bring, born in blood and terror. And that's the way this issue ends. So he's going to be fighting dinosaurs, and he is trying to figure out what is wrong with the symbiote and why their reunion is not all that it's cracked up to be. So if you are a fan of the Lethal Protector version of Venom, this is what you're getting in this book. And I'm very, very happy. Oh, I didn't say the creative team here. The creative team is Mike Costa, who's been doing a fantastic job on this book. Gerardo Sandoval is the artist. Dono Sanchez Almara is the colorist, and Clayton Coles does the letters, and the editor here is Devin Lewis. This is old school Venom, and I am really, really enjoying this book. So if you haven't checked it out yet, it's now back to the, though this is the legacy numbering, but it's a few issues ahead of this now, but it's definitely worth jumping on. I think this is a 3-issue arc, and it's a lot of fun.
So speaking of fun, for my last book, sadly, the last book I will ever review on Secret Identity.
The last book, Matthew.
Yes, this is it. We are going to go to a company that is doing everything right. And they are Alterna Comics. They are the company that decided that the quality of paper does not always have to be this 50,000-pound ultra-white cardstock expensive paper. They're using paper. Now, they talk about it being newsprint, but it's a little better than newsprint. When you first open up a book, you're going to be thinking, okay, it's not as cheap or crappy as I thought
it might be. But it certainly harkens back to that.
Yes. The comics are each $1.50. Most of them are mini-series. The one I'm going to talk about, Adam Wreck, is a 3-issue limited series. What I love that they do is they do it in the old Marvel style, where in the top right, left corner of the book, you've got the old logo with the pricing and the number underneath it. And then for the mini-series, it says it right across the top, and it says it in almost the same font.
And it seems like what they've done, and I might be wrong about this, is they're taking like indie series that might have been self-published before,
yes,
or come out under a smaller press, and they're basically building up their back catalog by having these now become part of the Alterna imprint.
Yep.
So I think that's pretty cool. I've read Lilith Dark from them. I've read Croak from them.
Yep.
It's one of the books I talked about here. But I do like – I mean, $1.50. That's the way to go.
Mother Russia by Jeff McComsky, who is the guy who does FUBAR.
Yes. That's a newer book, right?
Yeah. So, well, that's one that he's had. That was – I've had the originals of those.
Oh, you did. Yeah. So it is the case.
Yeah. So I picked them up again through this company too because I want to support it. But the books, again, you know, you talk about – it's like you're taking maybe a minuscule drop in quality of paper. It's not like they bleed all the way through. It isn't like you're seeing ink splots all over the place. It isn't like – Charlton Comics back in the old days. And I put a little post up on my Facebook page that it was like the old Big Boy comics. It's a lot better paper than Big Boy. But again, $1.50 a book.
Yep.
So this book is written and drawn by Michael Bracco. And we start out with a little kid. And he's like, my name is Adam Wreck. And he's like, I'm in big trouble. And you see that he's in a spaceship crashing onto a planet. And he's a teenager. And you see the ship land and crash. And he goes, mask. And then all of a sudden, this helmet comes over him. And he sees on his wrist that the atmosphere here is safe to breathe. So he takes the mask down. And you see, obviously, that this is a very futuristic kid. You find out as you read the story that his – and it's interesting, too, because it's a black and white story, but it isn't black and white. It's black, white, and orange.
Nice.
So there's a really cool contrast.
I like sometimes the selective use of color like that.
Yep. So that's the color palette, black, white, orange, and then maybe some gray.
Very Halloweenish.
Yes. So you see him and he's talking and it says damage report to your ship, 17% likely to fly again. And he's like, okay, this isn't good. I'm trapped. So you see a few hours ago, he is on a ship with his parents. Now his parents are super smart scientists that are doing all sorts of great things and they're discovering things. And he is a young kid, probably a preteen. Like, look, I'm bored. I don't want to do this. And his father's like, look, just go play your game. Enjoy the fact that we are discovering the cosmos. And he's like, I don't want to play my game anymore. I've been playing the game for so long. I don't want to play. I just want to go somewhere where there's people. And you see that that's kind of the struggle is he's being taken by his parents on this trip where he's got nobody. His parents have each other. He's got nobody. And as the ship is going through space, they end up in a galaxy that they've never been in. They're all excited about that until a pirate ship looking thing shows up and grabs a hold of their ship. And you see the flag. I'll show you, Brian. It's not necessarily a pirate flag, but it's not a very happy. It's not welcoming.
No,
that's not a flag that
says, I wouldn't call that welcoming.
Come on in, eat daily, you know, have food.
Sure.
We're open 24 hours.
We're all friends here.
So all of a sudden, the mother and father are like, get Adam into the escape pod right now. And he's like, I'm not going. I don't want to go. And then this tube comes in, breaks through the hull of the ship. They get him in the pod, and then they shoot him. And you see these nasty-looking creatures. And you assume it's a group of pirates that have kind of banded together because they're all from different species, and they don't look like they're very nice. So they grab a hold of the parents. They put him in the ship, and they shoot him down to this planet. But the aliens don't see that they have done that. So he's completely unknown to them. Crashes on the planet. Now he's walking around and he's starting to get a little sad. He's like, I'm never going to see my parents again. He starts to cry. And then as he's walking on a ledge that caves in. He falls down. And as he falls, he realizes that he is in sort of the nest of this big, gross looking thing because he's like lands on these things that are just pulsatingly looking gross. And he walks through because he's following a light and he sees that there's like this big star there on an altar. And I'll show you, very much out of the ordinary. And then you see incoming call on his wrist from his mother or from dad. And he's like, Adam. And he's like, thank goodness you're okay. And as he's walking, he's sort of inside, like they got him in a bag. So he is telling his son, just stay where you are. Somehow we're going to get to you. We're going to get you out of this as soon as we get ourselves protected, but they don't know you're there, so you're safe. And then the transmission ends, but he's telling them, you know, you're a good kid, and we love you to death. And then the aliens come out, and the aliens are looking for something, and they think that these two have it. And what you kind of start putting together as you read this is they're looking for what their son just stumbled upon.
Oh.
So he's, you know, the mother's like, what is happening to us? What are these things? Where's Adam? Is he okay? And he's like, look, Adam is okay. I sent him a message. He is okay. So we just need to have that faith. But then as he's getting the message, the thing goes dead. And he's like, oh no, what's going on? He's like, now I'm losing the signal. He goes running through this tunnel to try to get a better signal. And as he is running, he gets grabbed by this big octopus looking thing that is ready to eat him. And as he's getting ready to be eaten and the kid's screaming, somebody comes out of nowhere and goes, hey, ugly, and he shoots him, and he shoots the alien thing, and the alien falls off the cliff, and the kid falls off, and he's like, oh, great, thank you for saving me, mister. And he goes, Captain, just call me Captain. And he goes, and I didn't save you, Squirt, I was saving this. And you see that he was trying to grab something, it was an egg, and he said, there was an egg that's laying here, and it's worth a fortune, so that's what I was here for. And he's like, well, thanks anyway. By the way, where am I? And he goes, well, you're on this planet here and blah, blah, blah. I'm out of here right now. So now you've got a reluctant sort of scavenger, bounty hunter looking guy that is now unassumingly picked up a little kid that he now has to drag through through all sorts of adventures and stuff like that. And the kid's like, look, I need help.
Classic
please.
Team up.
Yep. And he's like, Squirt, I don't know what to do with you. But he says, I'm looking for this thing called the Trillium Star. And he goes, oh, yeah, I think I just found that. And he's like, what are you talking about? He goes, I found it. I found it. I know where it is. I've seen it. And he's like, the guy's like, you got to be joking. And he goes, you're a squirt. How would you know where it is? He goes, well, I just discovered it. By the way, I don't know how to get there. I don't even know where I am. So that is where this one ends. I've already read the second issue. I haven't gotten the third issue of this, but this was a ton of fun. It's a lot of fun to read a book that you're not under the pressure of forcing yourself to like it because of the price.
Yep.
We do that.
Well, that's the bottom line. I mean, at $1.50, you're going to try different books.
Yep. So what I did was I went on to their – I went to alternacomics.com and I went into their store where I bought every first issue that came out. And I will tell you this. It is worth it. I think it was $14 with shipping. I got an envelope, and when I opened up the envelope, I got all the first issues in a tote bag. And they were – there was like six in one bag and six in another with a board, so they were very well protected. I got a book called The Chair that was autographed. And they'll tell you – they'll say, hey, we may send you an autograph. We may send you a second or third print, but you're going to get all these issues.
Yep.
And I haven't even begun to get through there because there are some amazing books. It's a very varied universe too.
Yep.
There's like two horror books. A very psychological thriller, a war one, one about the end of the world. I can't wait to read Croak. I know you reviewed that one, but
yep.
That's the next book I'm going to start reading. And after I get through all these, I'm just going to go on and order the bundle of the second issues because I think that's
$12. Yep.
So I'm going to start doing that because I think that this is the way comics should be done. You can do it cheap. You can do it efficiently. And you can tell great stories. And I'm hoping nothing but success for this company because as long as they're putting books out, I'm going to be getting the entire line. And our good friend Keith Gleason has submitted to them.
Awesome.
So that'll be good.
Yep. I think that'd be a great fit for him. So, all right. Well, that's our comics, Matthew. Now, before we wrap up, we have a couple movies to talk about.
Yes.
You have not seen Thor Ragnarok yet.
Nope.
So let me start with that and let me give you the quick and skinny on that one. Thor Ragnarok, I think I posted this on Facebook, is now a top three Marvel movie for me in terms of the fun factor. I would say the original Sam Raimi Spider-Man, the first Guardians of the Galaxy, and this movie. And this is probably even number two right behind Spider-Man for me.
Wow.
It is absolutely hysterical, like genuinely funny. And I absolutely loved it. It reminded me so much of Flash Gordon. It is essentially, as much as it is a successor to the other Thor movies and part of this overall Marvel Cinematic Universe, I honestly feel like this is more of a spiritual successor to Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
This is like Flash Gordon 2. The color palette, it's very, the whole thing is a complete love letter to Kirby, but it is such a cosmic. It's so awesome, and it takes the Planet Hulk storyline and basically fits it to Thor while still including Hulk but not making him the star of it. Like, it just – it's so well done and, to me, was just a blast from start to finish. So if you have not seen Thor Ragnarok yet, like, I'm going to try and take my son today. He saw it with his friends, and I saw it when I was out in California. I want to take him to see it again so that we can see it together. That's how much fun it was. Like, it is, it's just hysterical. I loved it. And action-packed and, you know, cosmically weird and all that stuff. Jeff Goldblum, holy crap.
Everybody has said that.
Dude, he's playing Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is that so much of the dialogue is improvised in this movie that there are moments where you can almost see the other characters start laughing because this person has just said something that they have not heard yet, and they almost start laughing. There's a scene with Thor describing like why Loki is a jerk, and the story that he tells is freaking hysterical, and you can see Loki like start laughing, and then they cut away. Like, you can see that they were making stuff up as they went along, and it's freaking great. Like, it's so much fun. I adored that movie, so I cannot recommend Thor Ragnarok. I'll go see it again with you. Like,
yeah,
we can go see it together. Like, it's It's freaking amazing. And Korg, the director of this movie, who previously did What We Do in the Shadows, which is a vampire spoof movie.
Hysterical movie.
The guy who played one of the main characters in that movie and directed it is the guy who directs this movie and plays the voice of Korg, who is kind of the rock-looking guy that becomes Hulk's friend during Planet Hulk. Well, he becomes Thor's friend in this movie, and he is freaking hysterical. And Meek is in it too, the bug creature from Planet Hulk. It's so good, dude. And there's some great nods to things that you would know from the Planet Hulk storyline. It's so, so good. I loved it.
So on the other half of that, I went to go see Justice League. We saw that opening day.
Yep.
And I went into it. I think I even put a Facebook post up saying, go to see Justice League. I'm expecting nothing. Because all the trailer showed me was that this was going to be a video game. I didn't like the look of it. I didn't like the feel. I didn't like the characters. I didn't like much about it. There was nothing that I was holding as a positive going in it, except, well, it's a movie about my favorite heroes because I'm a DC guy. So going into it with that and coming out, I walked out going, that was a freaking awesome movie. And I mean awesome in the fact that you are entertained. It is a very entertaining movie. There is not a lot of boring moments in it. Every time they introduce a character, you are completely brought right in. I thought Aquaman was going to be that stupid bro dude that you were just like, just stop being the way you are.
Yep.
But for the first 5 or 10 times that you see him and he interacts with anybody, you're like, all right, I kind of understand his shtick. I might not be a big fan of it. But then he goes to Atlantis and runs into Mera. And I'm like, oh my gosh,
yeah.
I am in. And now I see why the guy's kind of acting the way he is.
That was my favorite Aquaman moment.
Yes.
For sure.
Teared up a little bit when I saw Mera. That was amazing. There is some humor in it that I think is somewhat well placed. It's not funny all over the place. The interesting thing that I also thought was I thought I was going to hate this Flash kid because I want
Ezra Miller, I think
I
his name
is. I want my TV Flash.
Yeah.
This kid was amazing. And if I say that he stole the movie, he might have stolen the movie. Just with his – every time he's on character, the personality, the wit. He is the most insecure of the heroes. He's the most unlikely of the heroes. And everything that he seems to have to do, he's got a phobia for.
Yeah.
Like, I got to fight a big bug. Oh, guys, I don't like bugs. And he gets really panicky. And I also love the fact that they're like, look, you're part of this team. You got to save people. He's like, I don't know how to fight. I'll save people, but I don't know how to fight, which you've always just assumed.
Yeah, there's that nice moment with Batman where Batman's like, save one person.
Yeah.
And then you'll figure out the rest. And yep. I thought that was kind of cool. And I believe that was a Joss Whedon moment, if I'm not mistaken.
And you can tell. You can tell the Whedon moments as opposed to the Snyder moments.
Yeah. I mean, it felt like it certainly – here's my thing. I enjoyed the movie overall. My son loved it. His friend loved it. Our buddy Jeff absolutely texted me last night and was like, I love Justice League. We know Daryl loved it. Like that. So, and I think a lot of people are unjustly hating on it because they're just Marvel fans and they want to, you know, kind of crap on it.
And the world is being very nasty to it. The movie press is being very nasty to this movie.
Yeah, and I think that has more to do with the fact that people who disagree with Zack Snyder's vision are going to continue to hate on stuff that he had a hand in. It's interesting. To me, this is kind of like a Jonah Hex situation. It's a billion times better than Jonah Hex.
Yeah.
But in that, what you can tell when you watch this movie is that this movie was created in the editing room.
Yes.
This entire movie was made in the editing room. So they shot a lot of footage and they clearly had some directions that they changed on the fly. And then whether it was Whedon and Snyder or Whedon coming in afterwards or whatever it was, someone put together a movie from the footage that they filmed. And so the pacing of it is extremely quick. It's 2 hours long.
It doesn't feel like it either.
In some ways, to me, I feel like the vision for this was, look, this movie has had a lot of ups and downs through the creative process. This is a huge movie for us. This is the tentpole movie of our cinematic universe. We need to, if we don't feel confident in making this a 3-hour long sprawling epic, then we need to cut a lean cut of this movie that is going to keep things moving very quickly, is going to keep the action going, is going to introduce people to these new characters while giving them what they love of these existing characters, and we need to get through this. And so that's in a lot of ways how I felt kind of watching the movie, is that I think they did the best that they could do with what they had at that time. I mean, switching directors, you know, before you go into reshoots is a huge, I mean, that's a humongous deal.
Yeah.
And to have it not feel completely incoherent is, to me, a victory in and of itself. There were definitely parts of the movie that were not developed well at all. The one gripe Parker had about the movie when he came out, he was like, I don't understand why they had that family there, Dad. Like, what the whole thing was with the family in the house. And this is my 11-year-old son saying that to me. It's because they did an awful job with that. They clearly put the family there because they wanted to have another reason for people to be in danger, because it gave Flash something to do, and it humanizes the fact that that part of the movie was a video game. So I totally get that, but that storytelling was awful when it came to that. And so it was just funny that my 11-year-old son is like, I don't get that. And he loved the movie. Yeah. He absolutely loved the movie.
Because you start looking nowadays at every single thing. It's like, what was the meaning of that family? Was the meaning?
And well, and it's in
and they, it make a no weird mistake. Introduction
it's
to
in
them.
Every movie.
Yeah.
Like, they have to put human beings at stake in superhero movies. It's the same thing with the first Thor movie when you had the gigantic robot come down and start destroying the town. Like, you have to put humans
in
danger.
It's all Eastern Bloc, if you've noticed, too. Because in the Avengers, it was the same thing.
But you have to put people in danger in order to care about them, because the superheroes can do whatever they want to do. So I get that. It was just very clumsy in this particular thing, in the way that that was handled. Things I love about this movie: Happy Superman. Happy Superman makes Brian happy.
Yep.
Like, the return of Superman, the scene where he returned, the scene where he was revived. I kind of dug the fact that they used the Mother Box technology to jumpstart Superman.
I thought that was super cool, too.
I think that worked well. The fact that he comes back and you knew they were going to have a fight where he didn't recognize everyone and stuff like that. But I thought it was well done, primarily because of how the Flash scene played out.
Yes.
The whole Superman looking sideways at Flash when he was going by, and how, like, shocked Flash is by that, of like, no one else can move as fast as me.
This guy is doing the same thing.
This guy's doing the same thing as I'm doing, and he sends him sprawling, I thought was awesome.
Yeah.
That whole scene to me played out awesome. Wonder Woman, freaking amazing. Like, you can also tell that this movie was shifted to shine more of the spotlight on her in this movie, and she becomes the heart of the movie for me. And I thought that was a strong move on their part. Like, I can't get enough Wonder Woman. I think that she maintains the heart and soul that she had in the Wonder Woman movie. And so that all worked well for me. Of the new characters, my favorite character was Cyclops.
Cyborg?
Cyborg, not Cyclops. He was, to me, the storyline between him and his father was the most story that we got. I mean, we got the obligatory Barry scene with his father in jail, right? But with Cyborg, you had the whole storyline of his father, the scientist who tried to bring him back, and he basically created a monster by doing that. Like, I thought they spent enough time with Cyborg's story to make it mean something.
Yeah.
And I liked that. And I thought that he did a good job with that. And Cyborg's a character who, unless you grew up watching Teen Titans, you're not that familiar with, right? And so the Flash is an easy sell. He has a TV show. People recognize the Flash. Aquaman is a pretty easy sell because they've really pumped him up in the previews of the movie. And Jason Momoa is pretty well known at this point. So he, to me, is an easier sell. He's the water guy.
And why do you feel like when you see him in this movie, he's not acting?
He's not, because he's just playing Jason Momoa. And so, which to me gets a little tired after a while. But he is just playing Jason Momoa in this movie. Ezra Miller, I thought, did a heroic job as Flash, because every single person in that theater is sitting there saying, I don't know why they're not using Grant Gustin for this. We have a Flash on TV. I already know what the Flash
looks
like.
I was that person,
I was the same thing. And the fact that this kid kind of won me over during the movie, I think, speaks a lot about the heart and soul that he put into his performance, because he had a thankless task.
Yeah.
He's coming in. He's the guy no one wanted to play the Flash. You know what I mean? Like, even when they announced him, everybody was like, what? No. Why? Who's this kid? Why is he playing the Flash? The fact that he is a standout character in this movie, I think, really speaks well of it and the job that he did in that. Like, I'm cool with him being the cinematic universe Flash.
Great. One of my favorite scenes in that whole movie is, obviously, you have J. Jonah Jameson, who's now Commissioner Gordon, which I thought was great. Yeah. But when he was talking to the
Justice
League,
more of him.
I did too.
Like, I hope he's in.
I want him to be in the Batman movies.
I hope that he's going to be. Like, I want to see more of him. Absolutely.
The whole scene when he was talking to the Justice League, and then all of a sudden he turns around, he's done talking, and
Flash is the only one there.
At first, you don't see, you think everybody's gone.
Yeah.
And then you pan over and you see Flash. He's like, oh my God, that was rude, because he should be the only one that could get out as quick.
Exactly, yes.
Which, I mean, a lot of those things, the big criticism people have had is the fact that you have Steppenwolf, and Steppenwolf is completely unrecognizable to me. I mean, to me growing up in the Kirbyverse, but people are freaking out in the fact that he was all CGI'd. And it's like, you know, you've got to kind of understand what was my biggest gripe with the X-Men, what was the last one that came out?
Oh, Apocalypse,
right? Was the fact that Apocalypse was like a foot taller than everybody else. You want your villain to be massive. You want him to be huge. You want him to be not very human looking. And I thought that they did a pretty good job with that. A couple of teary moments for me were when the Amazon sacrificed themselves to try to contain him. Like when they're running through and knocking the blocks down and each one going through is going to get trapped and die in there.
Yeah.
That was really emotional. And then the whole thing you said, like with Superman, when he came back and saw his mother, that moment. I teared up, but I was a little angry that they didn't save that for the next Superman movie. But I'm also hoping this is going to be the tone for the Superman movie.
I think they had to use that for this movie because you had to reestablish Superman as a likable character.
Yeah.
He was not likable in Batman versus Superman, and he was not likable in Man of Steel. And so if you bring him back, you have – to me, the biggest victory of this movie is that you reset Superman for the future.
Yes.
Right? And so coming back, you had to say, actually, people, Superman is not a boring, depressing dude. He's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
And look at him come back and take on all these other superheroes when he's confused and doesn't know who he is. He's as fast as Flash. He's, you know, stronger than all these other – like, he's amazing.
Yeah.
You should feel amazed when you see Superman. And then here, he's got a heart. He's happy to see Lois. He's happy to see his mother. He's not crying all the time. He's not miserable all the time. Like, those are the things they had to do in this movie to get people to even want to see another Superman movie.
Yeah.
And so that, to me, was the biggest victory of this movie, is that you made Superman likable again. And for those of us who love Superman, you made us see the Superman that we wanted to see again. So, you know, to me, my favorite scene of the entire movie is the after credit scene with Flash and Superman racing.
Yeah.
Because when they take off, Superman is smiling.
Yep.
That's all it takes.
And he smiles during the fighting scenes. Like, he has some quip and then he does some fighting. Yeah.
Like, thank you. That is the thing I wanted from the Justice League movie, is happy Superman again. And we got happy Superman again. So
The little clip at the beginning with the kids. Does that really, that S really mean hope? And they're like that interview, like kids filming at the beginning.
I'm sure someone has compiled a list of what the Joss Whedon stuff is versus what the Zack Snyder stuff is. But whoever's that was, like, that was great, because that was still sad Superman.
Yes.
In that it was him when they asked him, what's your favorite thing about Earth?
And he couldn't even.
And he couldn't think of anything. You're like, yeah, that's where he was. I mean, you know, Batman made him want to not live anymore.
Yeah.
Batman's jerk.
Yeah.
And so that, to me, was a great establishing of, like, when he died, he didn't want to even live anymore.
Yeah.
Like, so to have him come back and have realized that he absolutely has reasons for living, not just because he's needed as Superman, but because of freaking Lois and of his mother and of the fact that he cares about humanity and all that kind of stuff. Like, that, to me, was the most well-executed thing of the whole movie. Now, the whole CGI mustache thing was – there was a couple of parts where I was like, that looks worse than Steppenwolf. Like, it was awful. But there's nothing they could do about that. I cannot believe that they would not let him shave his mustache because he's working on Mission Impossible 6 or something like that. I can't believe that he couldn't shave his mustache for the reshoots. That is – beyond unbelievable to me that actually happened, and they had to CGI his mustache off of his face. Like, because, like, it's a needless distraction to great scenes of Superman coming back. But whatever, I got over that, man. Like, happy Superman, Wonder Woman still awesome. I do like Ben Affleck as Batman.
Ben Affleck plays one of the best Bruce Waynes we have seen.
It just sucks that the rumors are swirling around about him not being Batman anymore. It's like, dude, why does that have to be such a distraction? Like, but I like his Batman. Yeah, and the Steppenwolf thing, like, I understand they couldn't play the dark side card, like, immediately, but I was fine with Steppenwolf
yep.
as the main bad guy. I didn't even know that much about Steppenwolf, other than he's, like, a child of Apocalypse.
Yes.
And so I got that, and I thought they did a good job with the Mother Box stuff. So to me, it wasn't that he was a terror. It didn't matter who they were going to have the villain be in this one. Although I thought a cool... if they really wanted to go out there, it would have been Starro, because you could have had Starro show up and you could have had everybody be turned into Starro.
Starfish, yeah.
Yeah, starfish people.
Love it.
Which the thing that got me really thinking about that is on The Flash this week, Wally came back and he mentioned that he had fought Starro.
Oh, nice.
Which was awesome. But yeah, Steppenwolf, you can't play the dark side card in this first.
Yep.
Who are they going to build up to if not dark side? I mean, other than maybe doing something like the Blackest Night sort of thing when you get Green Lantern involved, yep. which that was an awesome nod.
That was a cool thing when you see the ring take off.
Super cool.
Yep.
Again, in that shot, just kind of reestablishing Green Lantern as part of this universe and stuff like that. So this movie had a lot of work to do in resetting the cinematic universe for DC. And I think for the most part, it did the heavy lifting that it needed to do. And so, you know, you can't compare it to a lot of the things that Marvel is doing in their cinematic movies. The Marvel cinematic movies built for what, 9 years?
Yeah.
They're in year 3 or 4 of the DC cinematic universe, and they've had their Justice League movie. Like, they had a lot of work to do with this movie, and I think they did the things that they needed to do to set a foundation for the future. So to me, I can't judge it as this culmination movie of everything the DC universe has been working towards, because it's not.
It's sort of this is their
first step.
Yeah.
So in order to kind of have that, like, you have to, they have to get through this. It's the origin story. So I think it did everything that it needed to do, and I enjoyed it overall, and my kids loved it, and I know a lot of people loved it. So despite the fact that critics have been kind of tough on it and it hasn't maybe hit the box office numbers that it was looking for, I think they pivoted in the right direction. And what I hope that they don't do is I hope they don't wipe the slate clean now and be like, well, we got to start over.
Yep.
No, you don't need to start over again. Understand that this movie had to happen in order to get you to where you need to be. The other lesson they hopefully have learned at this point is get Zack Snyder away from the DC cinematic
yes.
universe. That chapter is over now. Keep him away from it. You need to go lighter. That doesn't mean that you need to go sillier like the Marvel movies, but superheroes are about hope.
Yep.
You have to keep that going. If Wonder Woman taught you anything, it is that superheroes are about hope. And so that's the path to success for the DC cinematic universe. And we're out of the dark period now. So, you know, that again, I feel like that was the pivot that this movie needed to make. And it made that. And so now we go in a new direction.
Now we go.
And speaking of going, Matthew.
Yes.
It's time for us to go.
It's the big go.
It's time for us to leave you as the Secret Identity podcast. It has been 12 years. It has been probably 1,000 episodes, even yeah. though we've only numbered 800 of them. It has been, I would say, roughly 2,000 hours of audio programming, which is, you know, you could basically hole yourself up in a room and listen to Secret Identity 24 hours a day for a month if you wanted to get through all of the audio episodes that we've done. It's been hundreds of episodes with creators. It has been hundreds and hundreds of friends that we've made along the way, which to me will always be the best part of what we've done here. So even though we are leaving you for now, and I say for now because you never know what the future holds, but we are closing this chapter of the Secret Identity podcast. For those of you that have not checked out the Power Chords podcast yet, we invite you to do that, because it is basically this, but about music, on an every other week basis. And so Matt and I are not going anywhere. We are still podcasting together. We are still hanging out together. And we're probably hanging out more than we've ever hung out together, because we go to shows all the time now. And so that camaraderie and that banter and that discussion is continuing. So again, even if you're not a huge music fan, I would encourage you to go and check out the Secret Identity the Power Chords podcast. But I also understand that if you listen to us because you like to hear comics discussion, then this might be the end of the road for us. And all I can say to you is thank you so much for continuing to listen to this show. Our download numbers are as good as they've ever been, which to me is a great thing because we're leaving people at a time where they still enjoy listening to us. And so that's a great thing. The Facebook page is not going anywhere. If you are a member of the Secret Identity Facebook group, then please continue to hang out there and talk about comics. We will be posting about comics. We will be posting about movies. We will still be continuing discussion over there. The website's not going anywhere. It's not going to be updated as often as it was, but that's still a place for Matt and I to go and talk about comic books and to write about comic book movies and all that kind of stuff. So those things will continue to be around. And my hope is that my plan is to continue to put the archives of Secret Identity up on the Internet Archive, and I will put a link to that in the show notes. I believe the first 100 episodes of Secret Identity are up now, and so I will continue to build that library, and my hope is to have every episode of Secret Identity up on the Internet Archive. That's a long process, and that's something that I'm doing bit by bit, but the goal is to have every episode that we've ever done to go up on the Internet Archive so people can listen to them, and it will be the Secret Identity Archive. And so that's the goal now, is to take all the stuff that we've done for the past 12 years and get it up on the Internet Archive so that people can continue to listen to it. So, Matthew, I don't know if you had any final thoughts that you wanted to share with the listeners.
Well, you definitely hit a lot of nails on the head on that on those comments. That was great. And this has been a lot of fun. This is not as bittersweet as I would have thought it would be, but if we weren't doing Power Chords, I'd be bawling my eyes out thinking, this is it. This is horrible. I can't believe that, you know, we're not going to be doing this anymore. But the biggest thing, like you've mentioned, is for me, I think the friends that we have made.
For sure.
If it wasn't for this show, we never would have met the people that we have. And I'm not talking just the creators and all the people we've interviewed. I'm talking about the people that have listened to us and stuck with us and been here. And it is reassuring that the numbers never dropped. Like, we've been very consistent all the way through. You know, we've had some peaks, but our valleys haven't been the valleys of five people listening. I mean, we've always had people that have stuck with us, which has been great. We definitely kind of are doing that. We're going out on top thing. But we are also doing this because both of us were kind of running out of steam talking about comic books. It got to the point where I'll even say for like the last couple of years, I have found myself reading more out of obligation that I had to than wanting to read. And when you're reading something and going, all right, I'm going to talk about this one, or this is the book I'm going to talk about, it kind of took a little of that enjoyment out of it. But getting to know everybody, thinking about how this all started to begin with, the silly origin of your and my friendship is the whole basis of this. And you came into a comic book store that I was working at simply because I was putting up you drove by it a million times.
Yep.
And you told me, you're like, well, you know, there was a new Spider-Man book coming out, but it was the weekend after the movie Serenity opened up. I grabbed a bunch of posters at the movie theater. I was putting Serenity posters all over the wall, all over the window.
Yeah.
And that kind of caught your eye too. And you came in also on a day that I didn't normally work.
Which is crazy, right?
I mean, it was a Monday. I never worked Mondays. I worked Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Yeah. Never, ever worked a Monday, but had to work a Monday because one of the co-owners of the store with me had some family thing that he had to go do. So I'm like, all right, it's a tough weekend, and it's just all those weird things.
We could, for a month, talk about the things that have happened because of this show.
Yes.
This show has completely changed our lives.
Yes.
Like, in a way that is almost unfathomable. If you are a believer that there is no such thing as coincidences. There's plenty of consequences. But in terms of coincidences, like, I don't think anything is a coincidence, right? Mm-mm. Everything happens for a reason, and that's a very cliched thing to say. But when you think about, like, I just got a new job. That job would not have happened
absolutely
without Secret Identity, because that job was made, was brought to my attention by one of my good friends, Nick, who I do co-op critics with. How do I know Nick? Well, I know Nick through Jeff. How do I know Jeff? Jeff was one of the very first listeners of the Secret Identity podcast. He was one of the first people that ever reached out on the forums, and Jeff and I started playing Xbox Live together on the Xbox 360 in the days of the original Crackdown game. So playing Xbox with Jeff leads me to meet Nick. Nick and I become friends. I've been friends with both of these guys for a decade now. And because of Nick, I have the job that I have right now, which is a complete change for me. And that job also includes podcasting.
Yeah.
So none of that stuff happens. The writing stuff doesn't happen for either one of us because of Secret Identity. The New York Comic Cons, like unbelievable, dude. Like another connection to Power Chords that I will say is that a lot of the people that we've met and a lot of the creators that we've interviewed, guess what? They're big music fans. Yeah. And so if you think that Power Chords is never going to touch on comic books, you are mistaken, because you're going to find out very quickly on that show that there is definitely a connection to comic books. And we'll be inviting a lot of our comic friends to come on Power Chords and talk about the music that inspires them.
Greg Capullo is going to be probably one of the first, because I've got a great interview with him.
So you will see that thread run through that. So we're not completely moving away from comic books, but this is the next phase for Matthew and I, and we're very excited about that. And hopefully if you've listened to the first few episodes of Power Chords, then you are excited about that as well, because it is truly the Secret Identity template applied to the music that we grew up with. And that is what that show is. So that format and that discussion is not going anywhere. Nope. It's just not here anymore. And so again, if you are leaving us now as we are closing out this chapter for us, then thank you for all the hours that you have listened to this show. And thank you for the friendship. And thank you for, and please continue to go on the Facebook page. We don't want to lose touch with you. We don't want to lose contact with you, because we love those relationships. And so stick around, because that we're not turning all the lights off today. But check out Power Chords too, because we want to build the same type of community over there that has built up around Secret Identity. And so it's exciting for us. And it's a little bittersweet, because this is a chapter that we're bringing to a close now. But hopefully all the hours that we've put out there, people can still go back and enjoy. And again, just thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So for the final time, have a great rest of your week, and we will still talk to you soon, just not here anymore. But thank you, thank you, thank you for listening, and we will meet again, and we will talk again soon.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.